It's Draymond Green, kicking off my 14th NBA season and the new season of my podcast. And trust me, I'm not holding back. Listen to the Draymond Green Show wherever you get your podcasts. It's Draymond Green, kicking off my 14th NBA season and the new season of my podcast. And trust me, I'm not holding back. Listen to the Draymond Green Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get right to John Feinstein. He's been good enough to join us to talk about his new book. It's called The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. John, first of all, welcome. We're very happy to have you on our show.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. As I said, I appreciate it.
I'm an old sports writer, and you're a sports writer. I'm not going to put the tag old on you, and I did it for a lot of years.
Old, but...
What I want to know first and foremost, I think I'm a pretty decent writer. I can't imagine sitting down and writing a book. I don't have the patience or the concentration level, and you've written about a million of them. How do you do that?
Well, I think the honest answer is I really enjoy it. I was very lucky that my first book, A Season on the Brink, when I was in my 20s, did as well as it did because it allowed me to pick and choose my topics after that book came out and after it sold as well as it did. And I've always been able to choose topics I enjoy, to do books that I want to do, and to deal with people that I want to deal with. And the Ancient Eight's a perfect example because spending a season with Ivy League players and coaches was just a joy for me. I enjoyed every second of it except for driving on I-95 here in the Northeast.
So, you know, to tell the story of the Ivy League or even to chronicle just one season, you have to go back more than 150 years to the beginning of college football and when the Ivy League began to get together. So what connections were you able to make between then and now? Obviously, it's a very different game, but I know there's some tradition that has lasted that long. What did you discover in that area?
Well, first of all, as you know, Princeton played in the first college football game against Rutgers and lost 6-4 because back then the game was more like rugby than the football that we know today. And Princeton, on their helmets, they still wear 1869. So they want people to know they were part of that history. And the Ivy League has had a lot to do with all of college football's history. The Yale Harvard rivalry dates back to 1875. It is the game, no matter what Michigan and Ohio State say, because they were playing each other 20 years before Michigan and Ohio State ever heard of one another. And Princeton-Cornell is a great rivalry. And throughout the league, you have rivalries that date back more than 100 years. Years ago, the Ivy League teams won national championships all the time. When I walked into Harvard Stadium for the first time doing this book, there were 8 national championship banners. But the last one was in 1919, and no, I did not cover those teams. But the point being, back then they were national powers. Then the presidents in 1954 made a conscious decision as college football got more and more out of control, although nothing back then compares to what we have going on now, that they wanted to play football. They wanted it to be competitive, but they didn't want to sell their souls in the name of winning games. They didn't want to let guys in who were football players who shouldn't be going to an Ivy League school academically. They didn't want to spend millions of dollars on facilities and on recruiting and things like that. So they formed the Ivy League. The title of the book comes from that, The Ancient Eight, because there will never be an Ancient Nine or an Ancient Seven or an Ancient 12. We will always know the 8 teams playing in the Ivy League now and 100 years from now. It'll be the same 8 teams. And they, as I said, they made the decision to not compete for national championships and to compete with one another most of the time. They only play 10 games a year, and 7 of them are conference games. They play 10 games in 10 weeks, no postseason, which I disagree with, because the Ivy League teams in every other sport are allowed to play postseason, but the presidents won't let the football champion play in postseason. And I would make the case that they would be very competitive on the FCS level if they were allowed to compete in the tournament, which they're not. But there's so much history, tradition, legacy in the Ivy League, and yet the players who played the game today are very good players. There's usually between 12 and 15 of them in the NFL every season. And the competition is so fierce. I mean, I spent last year on the sidelines at every game I went to, and you can feel the emotion from the kids because most of them aren't going to play professional football. They're going to go to law school or med school or go to Wall Street. I hope they won't be sports writers. No offense, Bob. But it's so emotional because they love football, but they also know they're in college to get a degree and graduate.
Well, there's not a lot of Ivy Leaguers who go into sports writing, so I'm not too concerned, but we'll see. John Feinstein joining us. His new book is out, The Ancient Eight, College Football's Ivy League and the Game They Play Today. So we're all fascinated by the Ivy League. What's the school in the Ivy League that maybe doesn't get its due? Tell us what you think there. Which one is underrated? Well, which one do you kind of pull for?
Yeah, well, they're all very good academic schools, as you know. But In the last 18 months, the school that's been a unique story and a sad story is Dartmouth, because a year ago March, Buddy Tevens, who graduated from Dartmouth, was an all-Ivy quarterback and was a very good hockey player on a team that went to the Frozen Four in 1979. He had coached them for the second time round since 2005 and had turned them around from 0-10 to 7 Ivy League titles. And Buddy was also important because he was the first college coach who said, we can't allow all these head injuries to occur. We have to do something about CTE. And he called off hitting in practice. And the Dartmouth scientists actually came up with a machine that you could put on the field, and it would show the players how to tackle properly. And many schools are using that now because it's so valuable in terms of the safety of the players. But Buddy was on vacation. I had already spoken to him about doing this book, and he was very, like all eight coaches, he was very excited about it and was all for the project. And 2 weeks after I had that conversation with him, he was riding his bicycle home from dinner in Florida with his wife on vacation, and he was hit by a truck. And he barely survived the accident, lived for 6 months, but eventually died from all those injuries the week before Dartmouth's home opener last season. And I was in the locker room that day, and the talk that Sammy McCorkle, who was then the acting coach, gave to his players still gives me chills just to think about, because he was so firm about what Buddy would have wanted from the players and how proud he already was of the players and how they had handled his injury and losing another player, Josh Ballera, starting offensive lineman, to cancer. Josh died the day before Buddy's accident. So they'd been through so much. They won the game that day, and they went on to tie for the Ivy League title last year with Yale and Harvard, after being Big Six before Buddy died. And this year they're tied for first. And I don't know if you've ever been to Dartmouth, guys. I had never been before last year, but it is a spectacularly beautiful place. It does get cold in the winter, but it's almost – the other Ivy League schools refer to the people at Dartmouth, players, coaches, teachers, whomever, as being part of a cult in a good way. Because they all love it up there so much that once you get up there, and it takes a while, but once you get up there, you never want to leave.
Wow. So, you know, you mentioned that these teams were vying for national championships, and who in that era or longer than an era, it stretched out for a little while, who are some of the central Ivy League football figures of those times? And was there one who maybe even rose above the rest as kind of the central figure?
Well, one of the last ones who was a contender for the Heisman Trophy, two of the last ones I'll give you, Cosmo Iacovazzi, who played out of the single-wing offense at Princeton in 1962, The team went undefeated, and there were two prominent players signed by the New York Jets that year, Joe Namath and Cosmo Yakavasi. So that's certainly being a part of history there. And then in 1971, you guys might remember this, Ed Marinaro finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting while at Cornell and probably should have won and went on and played for the Minnesota Vikings for 10 years. And then afterwards, you might remember, went on to be a very successful actor on Hill Street Blues. And his son, Eddie, who's a wide receiver, is at Cornell right now. He's in his senior year.
Wow, that is amazing. Talking with John Feinstein, whose new book is out about the Ivy League and its football programs. I want to backtrack to you. You mentioned Season on the Brink, and talk about hitting the ground running with your first book. Of course, the story about Bob Knight and Indiana basketball. First of all, what made you jump into that fire at such a young age? And then secondly, how did you feel when Bob Knight passed away?
Well, I was very sad. I mean, he had a sad death because he had dementia. And the last couple of years of his life, he really didn't know where he was. I don't know if you ever saw a tape of his when he finally returned to Assembly Hall in Bloomington almost 20 years after he'd been fired. And you could tell just looking at him on television that he wasn't well. So it made me sad that he died the way he did. And I've always said, you know, Bob and I had our battles after Season on the Brink came out, but we eventually patched things up. But I've always said that I will be forever grateful to him because the access he gave me to do that book allowed the book to become the bestseller that it did. And the reason I quote unquote jumped in, to use your term, is, you know, I'm like any writer. I wanted to write a book. And, you know, I had asked Dean Smith about a similar project. A few years before, I had a great relationship with Coach Smith, and he said to me, "John, I wouldn't let my mother in the locker room." And my answer to that was, "But you don't curse, Bob. Why wouldn't you let Dean? Why wouldn't you let your mother in the locker room?" Bob did curse, but I developed a relationship with him, covering his Olympic team in '84, and I wrote a long piece on him during their terrible season in '84-'85. And he called me to thank me for it because he thought I was fair to him. This was right after he threw the chair and invited me to a dinner at the Final Four that he always had with his coaches and friends. This is when the Final Four was played in the afternoon on Saturdays. And I thought to myself, he's inviting me into into his inner sanctum. What if I could do that for a year and write a book? And I asked Bob about it at that dinner, after the dinner that night. Mike Krzyzewski was in the room because he and Bob were doing a clinic together the next day and they were planning it. And then I made the proposal to Bob to try to find a publisher to do the book. When we walked out of the room, Mike looked, as soon as the door closed, Mike looked at me and said, "Are you out of your blanking mind?" And I said, "What? What are you talking about?" And he said, "You're volunteering to spend a season with him? You're crazy." And I said, "Well, you played for him for 4 years. You coached for him." And he said, "Yeah, I needed to go to college. You went to college. I needed a job. You have a job. You're out of your mind." He wasn't wrong, but I'm glad I didn't listen to him. Five publishers turned the book down, and finally a sixth one, Macmillan, offered me an advance of $17,500 to do the book, and I did it. And 50 books later, here I am.
So real
great story.
Real quick, John, I'm curious because I think the first book of yours that I read was a while ago. It's crazy. But it was the Army-Navy book, which was obviously
right.
Fantastic. I'm just curious how your experience kind of with that book and around those people compared to your experience around Ivy League people, because those obviously are organizations that aren't first known for football. Were there similarities in those communities?
Very much so. Very much so. Obviously, there's no military aspect in the Ivy League, but Civil War in many ways, along with another book I wrote about Patriot League basketball, The Last Amateurs, really inspired this book because I enjoyed the players that I met and interviewed and wrote about in those two books so much. They both ended up on the bestseller list. I hope this one will too, but I enjoyed them so much. I thought, you know, wow, it would probably be a lot of fun to do a book on Ivy League athletes. I grew up in New York City. I went to Columbia games as a kid. They were terrible, but I still enjoyed going to the games. $4 to get in, by the way, and sit on the 40-yard line. So I went to my publisher and I said, you know, I'd love to try to do a book on Ivy League football. Unfortunately, he had read both A Civil War and The Last Amateurs, and he thought it was a great idea. And at least from my point of view, from the experience that I had, it was a great idea.
Well, your writing has touched a lot of people in your life, and I'm sure that's very gratifying. And this latest book, The Ancient Eight, about Ivy League football and its history, will do the same. Before we let you go, and thanks again, John, for doing this, is there an idea percolating in your brain for the next book?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. There are about five of them right now. And once I get through with this book tour, I need to sit down with my agent and my editor and see which of the five they like the best and which of the five I like the best. And I hope I'll get to do another one.
Well, we hope so too. Thanks for being on the show with us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, guys.
It's Draymond Green, kicking off my 14th NBA season and the new season of my podcast. And trust me, I'm not holding back. Listen to the Draymond Green Show wherever you get your podcasts.